couple minutes past 4 o'clock, which means it's time for our classic pick of the week, and to welcome my regular guest, Chris Carey, who kindly volunteers his time each week to select and research our classic picks and then comes in and shares his findings with us. This week, he's brought in a little gem from the Sundays. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Yeah, thanks. I'm happy to be here. And so this week, I figured we would look at the Sundays. Their debut, Reading, Writing, and Arithmetic, came out January 15th, 1990. This album is not as huge as a lot of classic picks, but I think that it was very big in an underground way, specifically in a college rock scene in the early 90s. 1990 is when this record came out. The band, they formed, they didn't form in London like most UK bands. They actually, the two main characters in the Sundays were lead singer Harriet Wheeler and David Gavran, who met while attending Bristol University. They began dating. They were an item. They both had a shared love of music, but never much really of a background in music. And Harriet Wheeler just kind of started writing lyrics and playing with them a little bit while they were in college. And then when they graduated, they moved to London. She started working on these songs more, and they soon enlisted bassist Paul Brindley and drummer Patrick Hannon and started playing out. And, I don't think any of them at first they were just kind of playing around and having a good time. And then they realized, you know what, these songs, they're pretty good. And so they made a demo and they sent them around to clubs in London. And they, immediately people started booking them. And on one of these shows that they were, I think it was actually their first show in 1988 that they were on, and they were the support, and there just so happened there were several music writers in town that were there for the headliner, but they were also enamored by the Sundays that they all wrote about the Sundays. And then after that, a big kind of local buzz developed with the Sundays, and by the end of 1988, they were signed to Rough Trade Records. About that time, they'd only recorded one single that was actually released in January of 1989, Can't Be Sure. John Peel He heard it and loved the album and had them on his Peel session. Which was for those of you who don't know, John Peel was a famous DJ who was on BBC Radio 1 from 67 to 2004, I think, when he died. And he was kind of the tastemaker from the late 60s through the end of the century in London. And if you were kind of somebody that dabbled in a kind of underground, less than mainstream kind of genre, if John Peel liked you and played you on his show, he could make you. And
yeah, he's responsible for bringing a lot of amazing artists to the forefront, for sure.
And indeed, he loved the Sundays, and he loved the single Can't Be Sure, and so it ended up being his number one pick single for 1989. And so, obviously the new label, Rough Trade, loved this. And they wanted them to record, but at the time, all that they had as a new band were three tracks, really. So they spent most of 89 writing these tracks. I mean, a lot of bands that when they first get signed, they've already been a band for
several
years and have a ton of material. And so it's kind of impressive that this album, which really, I'm not kidding, every single song on this album is totally a good song. There's no filler here at all, and it's kind of amazing that they wrote these 12 amazing tracks within less than a year. And what I love about them is that on top of Harriet Wheeler's voice, kind of, I think, angelic is not hyperbole. She has got this beautiful voice.
Yeah, that's accurate.
But on top of what, I love the lyrics. They're kind of simple and sweet and bucolic, and at the same time, really wry.
And they're not saccharine. They're sweet without being saccharine.
And the lyrics are really good. Like this is one of those albums you can listen to and really enjoy the lyrics or read along the lyrics with while you're listening to it. And it's kind of, they're very, like, wry is a great adjective. But when they finally did get into the studio, basically, again, they were a new band, and so they didn't play in any huge, super expensive studio. They recorded over 1989 at various studios around town. Ray Shulman was the producer. He started off his music career as a bass player for a prog rock band called Gentle Giant. I think most people that would know them would only be people that were super prog rock aficionados. But he did, interestingly, he actually produced some other 1980s, early 90s bands like the Sugar Cubes and Trash Can Sinatras. He worked with Ian McCullough from Echo and the Bunnymen, too. Commercially, this became a surprise commercial hit. It ended up reaching number 4 on the UK album charts and number 39 on the Billboard 200 and sold well over 500,000 copies. And you know, that's pretty... I mean, it's not, you know, 50 million copies or anything, but selling 500,000 records is kind of
more than respectable
on a date, yeah. A debut album on this little indie band on a small indie label is pretty impressive. They were they became, like I said earlier, they became super big mainstays on college radio stations throughout the U.S. and MTV played their material quite a bit, especially on 120 Minutes. For those of you out there old enough to remember that, we would stay up late on Sunday night just to watch 120 Minutes.
The dawn of the alternative nation.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome, actually. Anyway, critically, it was super warmly embraced by everybody. Everybody loved Harriet Wheeler's vocals. Everybody loved their lyrics. And everybody loved the guitar, which kind of... It'll directly, you know, it's totally obviously influenced by Johnny Marr from the Smiths and his guitar playing, but it kind of also has kind of this Roger McGuinn Birds kind of vibe too.
It's definitely, it's got that deeply, deeply layered sort of pretty jangle thing to it.
Yeah, very jangly. Jangly is a good adjective for this guitar playing, which you'll hear momentarily. But, and then after they released this, there was a couple of years later, they released their sophomore album called Blind, and it did about as well. It didn't get as big a critical reviews as the debut, but it sold about 500,000 records too. And then their third album, Static and Silence, which didn't come out until 1997. Again, it didn't do as well with the critics, but it had their best-selling single on it, which was a song called Summertime. Following that third album, the group went on a hiatus, and Harriet Wheeler and David Gavran, they had two kids and raised a family and kind of retired from the music world. There was some talk, I think, in 2014 about them maybe doing something again, which I guess would make sense. Both those kids have got to be in their 20s at least by now. To this point, nobody else has done anything, or they have not done anything else. And while some people might say the Sundays are not necessarily a major influence on subsequent bands, kind of in my humble opinion, they really are. This was, I think, one of the best indie releases that came out in the late 80s, early 90s. And I think a lot of other people that are familiar with this record would agree. And I have heard, we were talking about this a little bit before we went on, in that I've heard other people compare the Sundays to the Cranberries or the Cardigans, but... I mean, there wouldn't have been a Cranberries or Cardigans without the Sundays. The Sundays predated them by about 4 years. And so there were these bands later in the 90s that I think were totally, you know, mirroring what they heard in the Sundays. And again, even later on in that, I don't think there'd be a Burden to Be without the Sundays.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting to think about the distinction between a band or an artist that's a specific influence on a bunch of artists and an artist that sort of sets the stage culturally. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Creates the atmosphere where other artists of that ilk are going to be well received. And that's, these seem kind of like stage setters.
Yeah, and so when you hear this now, what I like about this album is it doesn't sound completely out of time, but it does. I remember when it came out in 1990, I remember buying this record, and at first I was like, what is this? Because it sounded completely different from everything else that was going on in the late 90s. The only thing that kind of sounded like anything else was the Smiths kind of guitar. And other than that, it kind of sounded totally different at the time. And still this day, like it's still... Like I said, I was listening to it all weekend long, and I thought, you know, this record is still as good as when it came out in 1990.
Wonderful. I'm talking with Chris Carey about the Sundays, Reading, Writing, and Arithmetic. Our classic pick of the week came out right around this time, 30 years ago. Anything to add before we go into your first selection?
Yeah, I did, and this is the geek in me coming out, but... I wanted to comment on the cover art. I've always loved this cover
art.
Yeah,
me too. What's the story there?
So it's just a black and white photo of Ammonites. And Ammonites, I mean, anybody that goes to the Jim and Meryl show every February has seen Ammonites. And Ammonites were these cephalopods, basically, that had spiral shells shaped similar to a ram's horn.
Oh, that's what these are.
Yeah, and so they're named Ammonites after the Egyptian god Ammon, who was a ram. or had ram horns. And so these Ammonites are named for an Egyptian god. And so it made me think, well, first of all, it's kind of cool because so Ammonites are basically, they're related to nautili and octopi and cuttlefish and squid. And they were really cool, and they were all over the planet, and they died out 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs did. And there were several different kinds of species, and they're very prolific as far as fossils go. That's why you see so many at the Gem and Mineral Show. But it made me think, I was like, I don't recall seeing too many other albums with fossils in the cover art. And so I was looking into it. And
love your geeky side.
There was one fossil album
artwork investigation.
Yeah, yeah. And there was, I actually found one other album that also had an Ammonite on the album, and it was XTC's Fossil Fuel, which is their greatest hits that came out in 1996. And the only other album, I'm sure I'm missing something, so people can let us know if they know some other albums that have fossils on them. But Alice in Chains released.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's a metal kind of thing.
Yeah, but they had a Triceratops skull on their cover, their 2013 LP. Yeah, I'm kind of curious if there's other albums out there with fossils on them.
Well, Red Fang have some sort of prehistoric.
No, Red Fang. They've got a Smilodon, a saber-toothed cat. Yeah. Which I think that's the best genus name for saber-toothed cat, Smilodon. That's pretty awesome.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much, Chris, as always.